Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, February 23rd. We continue to check in with commercial property owners looking to rebuild in Lahaina, a daunting process for many. And will artificial intelligence replace simple skills like curiosity and critical thinking? Schools grapple with the issue in a world where our young people are growing up in the AI era. It was billed as the first championship Konani tournament in modern history. We chat with one of the organizers about the ancient Hawaiian game. And what do you get when a Hammond organ and a drum kit walk into a bar? Bada boom. Find out at a concert tomorrow when music and improv take the stage. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The rebuilding of Lahaina from the 2023 wildfires took center stage last week, drawing more than 60 people. It was meant to help commercial property owners navigate the red tape. HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel was there to hear their concerns about the process. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what was it like?
Yeah, so, you know, up until now, there's been a real focus on rebuilding homes, which, of course, has been an ongoing process, very important for residents to get back into Lahaina. And now the focus is kind of shifting more toward rebuilding commercial properties. And so, as you mentioned, you know, about 60 commercial property owners from Lahaina were there at this county workshop last week. They're facing a lot of challenges in rebuilding. And so the county was there to kind of help them navigate the process, understand the different steps, of which there are many involved in rebuilding their commercial buildings in Lahaina. And so a handful of them have made it through the process and have rebuilt already, but most that I've talked to haven't even started the permitting process yet, and some don't even plan to because of how daunting it is. So the county staff, you know, talked through, dozens of slides talking about the maps and the requirements. You know, think about layers being stacked on a map, and the closer you get to the ocean, the more layers there are, and each layer brings a different permitting requirement, and some of these are through the county, some of them are through the state. The closer you get to the shoreline, you know, the more challenging it is because of, you know, shoreline setback rules, and also in Lahaina, you know, a lot of historic properties, historic districts, and so many layers to work through. Here's County Planning Director Jackie Takakura explaining some of that process during the workshop.
So step one would be to find the property on the map. Let's first look at how the location on the map determines the permit requirements. And what this map shows here are areas and numbers of property, including pink colored area are the commercial properties in the historic districts. And we have a count of 87 damaged commercial properties there in the pink. In the yellow is the National Historic Landmark District, and we have a count of 36 damaged commercial properties. And then I also have the Limahana area because there are 18 damaged commercial properties in that area. So generally speaking, the further Mauka you go, the less requirements you have. And as we go in the Makai direction, then the special management area and the shoreline rules kick in. And then also within the NHLD and historic districts, HCDs, there can be impacts on the requirements. So the pathway is going to depend on the location of the property.
I can see how that can get very complicated very quickly, particularly in the historic district.
Absolutely. And, you know, I walked away. I mean, they did a great job of explaining it, but I walked away truly mind-boggled by how many different layers and requirements there are. One Maui architect I spoke with after the workshop did confirm he's been working with a number of commercial rebuilds. And he said above the highway, basically, they're moving along well. But those that are below the highway, again, more in the Makai direction, are much more complicated. He said, you know, they have to raise the floor, flood requirements, all kinds of things. And so to date, commercial permits, there are 9 non-residential buildings that have been completed in Lahaina. So made it through the whole process, got their certificate of occupancy are done with the permitting process. 25 permits have been issued by the county, so those may be, you know, kind of in the building process now. 163 non-residential permits are in process, so at some point, you know, in the permitting office, according to Maui County. Non-residential can mean commercial, it can mean business, it can also mean multifamily buildings, so anything other than, you know, single-family dwellings. So, you know, a lot in the process of permitting, and as I said, a lot of folks that I talked to there actually haven't started the process of permitting yet. So a handful of commercial building owners right along the shoreline had buildings, you know, a lot of the restaurants, when you think of Lahaina, overhanging the water. And all of those buildings that were out over the water actually had state leases with the Department of Land and Natural Resources for the portions of the building that were over the ocean. They were called submerged land leases. And the county says all of those leases were actually voided in the fire. And so the owners have to contact DLNR on an individual basis regarding renewal. You know, just another layer of complication there for those handful of owners right along the water. One owner that I talked to, Mary Jo Abrams Manuel, her family's building was right between Kimo's and the Yacht Club. And she told me, you know, they have to have the building permit in hand before DLNR can actually issue, may issue a lease renewal. You know, she said they're having trouble hearing back from DLNR. But the process basically is so daunting that she's lost, you know, a large portion of her land to erosion. And so she doesn't think they're going to rebuild at all. She's now considering a county buyout option that we'll talk more about in a little bit. But here's Mary Jo Abrams Manuel after the workshop kind of telling me about her options.
Ours is a trust, a family trust. And so we have not been able to consider rebuilding. What I do know is that the erosion and the lack of the DLNR lease on the ocean front has caused our property to become about 1,600, 1,700 square feet.
And what was it before?
It was an upstairs, downstairs, and it was 4,300 altogether. I'm 77. And I'm in a lot of fear. It's ruined our life. I'm really grateful. And I grew up in Lahaina, right upstairs at my mom's place. Don't tell anybody, but I used to do spitwads at the Yacht Club ladies from upstairs. So
the business was downstairs and you first lived?
Upstairs, yes. And then our last tenants was an art gallery. And they took the upstairs and the downstairs. And so I just feel like I'm treading water because I don't know where to go. I don't know who to ask.
Oh, you can just hear the emotion in her voice. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, such a challenging process to navigate. And as I mentioned, you know, she was there at the workshop. She was looking into this county buyout option. And so the county says that federal funding will be used for this voluntary program. About over $200 million of the $1.6 million in federal disaster recovery funding that the county received is allocated toward hazard mitigation. And so a portion of that $200-some million will be used, apparently, for this buyout program. It hasn't rolled out yet, but the county will be accepting comments on the program next month. And those parcels that, you know, the owners do opt into this buyout program would become part of a green space area along the shoreline. And so the permitting process, you know, like for like builds is, you know, building it as it was before. That's what the owners of Pioneer Inn plan to do. Kimo Falconer's great grandparents built the iconic building, and he told me they do eventually plan to rebuild as it was.
I mean, that's the easiest thing to do, to try to make it the best you can. It's not like we're trying to, you know, grow in size to like an 11-story building or anything like that, no. You got to keep in spirit of, you know, what my great-grandparents did when they built it. That's kind of our aloha. That's the way we feel about it, you know. It really passed my mind to try and do something else. We, you know, Lahaina needs to look the way it did. And that's a big part of it, I think. I think, you know, working with Front Street Recovery, our other group, which is all the landowners on the commercial area of Front Street, everybody sort of seems to see eye to eye and all of that stuff. I don't hear a lot of people saying, we want to change this, we want to do that. They just want to build it back the way it was. There's a love for Lahaina that just about everybody automatically just shares. Just, I think because they've been on the land for so long. I'm talking generations when I say long. So that's a cool thing.
Let's hope they can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Another workshop coming up on April 7th, so more to come.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Catherine. We've been hearing HVR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel reporting on a meeting held last week to help Lahaina's commercial businesses recover from the wildfires.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the 15th Honolulu African American Film Festival on Now, telling stories of the Black experience. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Greetings, I'm Lulu Solares, your new Friday night host on After Hours, Hawaii Public Radio's new weeknight late night music space, where each night brings a different host, genre, and point of view after dark. Join me for Mundo Reggae, Worldwide Reggae, past and present. Music to soundtrack your life after hours. Fridays, 10 p.m. to midnight on HBR1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Does artificial intelligence mean a college education is no longer worth it? A new report from UHERO, the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization, surveys the AI landscape. Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Victoria Budiono joined us in the studio earlier today to talk about the rise of AI in classrooms and the workplace. Is a college degree still worth it for our keiki growing up in a tech-driven world?
The UHERO report suggests that college education still matters. I think right now with all this technology and AI, we often worry that college isn't as worth it anymore. I think with the threat to white collar jobs, but that's not the case. So we just need to be AI literate, and AI kind of shifts the way jobs work, but it's not saying that they're not saying that we don't need education anymore.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we've heard the change is going to come fast and furious, and it has. Between, you know, people using ChatGPT or, you know, all these chatbots to do their work, to maybe make their work more efficient, but I think there's a concern that people are relying on it and we're going to lose our skill to be able to think critically, you know. So what are the economists saying about how we need to deal with that?
Well, Hawaii, we've been having a lot of conversations with digital literacy, right? And basically, they're saying that it's important to have literacy with AI as well. And I've been having conversations with educators, economists about how Hawaii might fall behind if we don't advance in that way. But that's just like how it is with technology and everything, right? And like, especially in rural areas. And that might be hard because in many places in Hawaii, we're not even digitally illiterate yet. So how would it look like if the entire world is advancing with AI and stuff and we're just left behind?
Right. Yeah. We all the talk about the digital divide and trying to even the playing field for everybody. But I know schools are grappling with how to deal with technology, and I don't know if they can get out in front of it fast enough.
What are the educators saying?
Well, the educators emphasize that what becomes more valuable in this AI-driven world is what they call like timeless or vintage skills, and it's curiosity, adaptability, human judgment, interpersonal communication. So AI can generate content, but without the subject knowledge, students won't know how to like critique or validate what it produces because AI can be wrong.
Oh, yes. And and can hallucinate big time.
Yeah. So that's where the higher education or education in general still plays a critical role. I think in my article, it said Brian, a teacher at Mid-Pacific, he said that you can't necessarily teach curiosity, but you can definitely kill it. So I think that's important for educators to keep in mind with, you know, students, is that learning doesn't just stop there. You have to keep teaching them how to just don't suppress the curiosity part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. And, you know, MidPac has really tried to distinguish itself as being out there as a technology school, mm-hmm. Trying to stay ahead of the curve and not just always be chasing technology, whether it be AI or iPhones, because we just watched so much happen, changing our operating systems, really, you know, just because it's just come so fast.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is that I think the researcher that I talked to, Stephen Bondsmith, he noted that many entry-level jobs traditionally involve like routine tasks, the kind AI can now do quickly. So there's concern that if AI handles those tasks, then graduates or students in general could miss early training opportunities that could help build long-term productivity. So institutions may need to just like rethink how students gain that hands-on experience. So it's nice that I think DOE is doing a lot of this, UH as well, where they're like workforce careers opportunities at a younger age. But what's also interesting is that the conversation doesn't stop with just like white collar work. Generative AI is disrupting office-based roles, but automation technology is also becoming more visible, and this is something that maybe we could look into in the future. It's becoming more visible in blue-collar industries, right? So we're seeing a lot of more robotics in construction or manufacturing, even service robots in restaurants. So it's not always AI in like ChatGPT or Google Gemini sense. It's AI-powered technology that's reshaping physical labor too.
Yeah, and I know that University of Hawaii is trying to position itself to really handle all the AI changes and to innovate when it comes to technology.
Yeah. UH has been good with that. I haven't really looked into it that much, but I know that they have a new Office of Academic Technology that helps integrate AI across its campuses. So, I mean, if the institutions are doing it, I guess we should look into it and follow it.
Yeah,
closely.
Well, it's an interesting article opening up our eyes to what's not just coming, but what's already here.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Star advertiser reporter Victoria Budiono with a look at AI in our economy. That was the lead story in the Sunday edition. Look for her story at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Halau of O'ewi Art in Wailuku, Maui, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
Some countries in Europe are backtracking on their green energy transition. France is set to pass a decree to slash its wind and solar goals. That comes on the heels of the EU repealing a ban on new combustion engine vehicles starting in 2035. I'm Marco Werman. Hear that story and the day's top global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, featuring medium dark Kau Marugohipe with a caramel forward profile and notes of cacao and Meyer lemon. BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com.
Thank This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We're out in the greenery for today's backyard quiz. We're searching for a native group of insects that can do amazing things while in flight. This insect group has been around since the time of the dinosaurs, and there are some 2,000 varieties here in our state. Often recognized by their distinctive moves in the air, these creatures can hover and also clock in speeds up to 35 miles an hour. They have long, lacy wings that beat so rapidly they blur to the naked eye. And they have another trick. They mate in midair. Afterwards, the female lays tiny eggs on the submerged stems of taro plants, and gestation can take 2 or 3 years. They're usually found near fresh water and feed on the smaller insects that they catch and devour while in flight. For today's quiz, can you name these amazing flying insects? We'll take the answer in English and Hawaiian names. Here's a hint. A sculpture of a one graces the pool near the bandstand at Kapi'olani Park here in Honolulu. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag. And you'll also score a deck of the card game Kumala'au, courtesy of Trees for Honolulu's Future.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
We'd like to take a moment to share recent feedback that you sent us. After we highlighted former lifeguard Mark Dombreski's story of the jet ski rescue system, Robert Sanchez wrote, "I was a young Hapa'haole kid trying to keep up with the big Waimea shorebreak body surfers back in the late 70s, and Mark was one of the lifeguards at Waimea. He was always very cool to me, never turned down a request to borrow one of the extra boogie boards that they kept in the storage room." And many of you sent us your own memories of the humorous Hawaiian rental signs. Jamie Koldo writes, "The best one I ever saw, want to get high, rent a ladder. That's how I finally figured out what they sold." And Scott says, "I used to look forward to passing that sign when I was in that area for decades. It was always a fun thing wondering what it was going to read. We need more stuff like that around. Props to the owners." On Instagram, former reporter Erica Engel wrote, "I interviewed the then new owner many years ago. I was at PBN, I think, and I asked him about the sign, telling him that he was definitely going to have to keep it going. I think the business has since changed hands again, and along with everyone else, I am grateful Hawaiian Rental has kept it up." We do appreciate the feedback. Let us know what you think. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can also email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Players faced off around an antique Konani board earlier this month that had been used more than a century ago. The board is one of only 6 in existence today, and it felt especially fitting that the Bishop Museum brought it out for the inaugural Konani Invitational Tournament. Kapena Baptista went home with the win and a replica of the museum's rare board. Baptista is a Konani advocate and co-organizer of the tournament. The Conversation's Kellen Allen spoke with Kapena about why he's worked so hard to uplift this ancient board game.
All this really started from a collections visit here at the Bishop Museum. I was very interested in Konani just as a piece of our Hawaiian material history, kind of like tangible cultural heritage. And I was aware that the Bishop Museum was in possession of three wooden papamu, otherwise known as Kwanani boards, and they had never been on display ever since their acquisition. So I was very interested in looking at them. So it was just really a cold email. I got to see the boards, and they were just marvelous, really, really wonderful examples of our kupuna's craftsmanship. And then just something called out to me when I saw them that, like, these are objects that are meant to be used, yeah? I mean, these are literally game boards, something that our kupuna spent hours and hours enjoying themselves with, but also, you know, busying their minds with the endless complexity that Konane has to offer. So with that in mind, with that feeling in my na'au, where the Hawaiian brain is located, I really felt a need to, you know, figure out ways where we can activate these objects. I kind of hesitate to even call them objects because in our view, these are really our ancestors. This is something that they left us. And for me, it's a shame to just have them on the shelf. And you know, the partners here at the Bishop Museum have been so fantastic and so willing to think about this seriously and not just kind of shoo me off, but really think about, yeah, maybe these objects are in a really good state. They're not at risk of you touch it, then they disintegrate. You know, some things are like that. But, you know, there was definitely a possibility for this to happen. And that first collections visit occurred in October 2024. You know, it's February 2026, so it's over a year in the making for all this to happen from kind of inception and thought to finish and execution.
And I heard that the championship match will be played on one of these boards. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. It is a very, very special board from the Kapi'olani Kalani'ana'ole collection. It was acquired by the Bishop Museum in 1923 as a gift from the Princess Kahanu. And to the museum's knowledge and to everyone's knowledge that's looked at it, it has never been played on since, right? So we're talking about over 100 years of it not ever being played on. There are a series of other boards, or two other boards that are in the museum's collection, that are actually of much older origin. They were actually acquired by the Hawaiian National Museum in 1891, so even during the kingdom days. And some of the descriptions on one of them says already a very, very old board, right? So I get asked all the time, you know, like, where does Konane come from? Or like, what is it? Yeah. And you know, Konane is something very uniquely Hawaiian. It exists nowhere else in the world. And in fact, nowhere else in Polynesia. A lot of things that we have in Hawaii have analogous things that occur on our kind of cousin islands, but Konani is not one of them. It's something that only exists here and is kind of the brainchild of some very, very brilliant kupuna out there. And I just think it's so special that we as Hawaiians could kind of really claim ownership of that and really make it our own.
Yeah, and speaking of the way the Western world has seen Konani, an often used descriptor is that it's Hawaiian checkers. And so tell me why that is just so not true.
It's kind of been the bane of my existence for a very long time. I mean, and it was something that the description of it being Hawaiian checkers actually turned me off of Konane when I was young. You know, I'm kind of a nerdy kid, yeah, and I wanted something, you know, a little bit more complex. So that kind of turned me to chess, you know, and I was playing chess for a very, very long time and got really into it. And then it wasn't until the pandemic where I came back to Konane, you know, after a decade of playing chess, and then I started playing and I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, this is not checkers. This is not checkers at all. We have to stop calling it that because the purpose of it is so different. The goal of it is so different. And the undergirding philosophy that underpins so much of it is just so different from just calling it checkers. And that really inspired me to look into it a lot deeper. And you know, I wanted to know, you know, kind of what the origin of it was calling it checkers was from. And it turns out it comes from Captain James Cook's crew. That they saw it. They witnessed it being played everywhere. And they were like, oh, we don't get it. It looks complicated, but they're jumping over pieces. It looks like checkers. So we're going to call it checkers. So that's where that comes from. So every time we call it Hawaiian checkers, we're kind of taking the perspective of James Cook here. Yeah. And for me as a native Hawaiian, I think that's kind of wrong for us to do. And that it's incumbent upon us to really understand Konane as it is on its own. And kind of putting my anthropologist hat on right now, we like to think about games as being expressions of kind of cultural thought or values. And when you think of a game like checkers, what's the goal? The goal is to completely exterminate your opponent. Yeah, you leave no one alive. You're just completely exterminating them. And from our perspective as Hawaiians, that's not a Hawaiian value. You cannot just eat everything up on an island. You're not going to survive. There needs to be some kind of regenerative aspect, some idea of looking forward toward the future. Our game is what we call pili, very related to Hawaiian martial arts, lua. And lua, by extension, is related to hula, right? So these are things that are very concerned with movement of the body, yeah? And lua in particular, I don't know if you've ever seen like a lua practitioner or people doing those kinds of things, but they're not concerned about killing you, so to speak. They're more concerned about subduing you, right? I'm going to break your legs or something, or your arm or your shoulder. Very kind of similar in Konane, where I'm not trying to take all your pieces. I'm just trying to make sure that you can't have a move, that you cannot make a valid jump over my piece, and that you're completely locked up. And you can see an end game in Konane and see a lot of stones still up there. And you're like, wait, how is this game over? Then you look really closely. It's like, oh, black cannot jump anywhere. And white just has them completely, you know, like locked up. And it's something very, very different from Western games. Yeah. And I think that has a lot of value for us, not just as Native Hawaiians, but everyone that lives in Hawaii, everyone that lives in an area or a space that needs to regenerate its resources sustainably. Yeah.
And I think it's always so interesting with games that are complex like this, that there are so many strategies, right? There are so many ways to win. And if you look at, for example, chess, right, there's books written about openers in chess. Can you tell me, I guess, not only just how deep the strategy in Konane is, but also maybe how it's changed throughout the years?
That's a really interesting question, actually. So as far as like Konane theory goes, there's almost nothing written about it, at least from a modern perspective. There is one resource we have. It actually comes from the Fornander collection, written sometime in the late 19th century. And that's really the only resource that we have where he describes names of moves or sequences of moves. And they're very, very interesting, right? And from a particular stone, right? The Hawaiian and even the English that it's written in is a little hard to comprehend in a way, right? So, we have a small hui of folks that will take a look at it, and we're all just kind of scratching our head. We're like, we don't really know what this means, right? But it's like, imagine you have like a game like chess, and you hear of something called like the Queen's Gambit, but they don't show you what it is. You just know that it's out there, right? And this sequence exists, but you don't know what it looks like. That's our situation right now for Konane. That we know that there is a sequence of moves called Kaniupi'i or Ele'ele Ualani. We just have no idea what that means, right? We know what the name is, right? But like, what does it look like on the board, right? So a lot of, I think, the goal moving forward for Konane practitioners or really players at a high level is, you know, thinking about these names and maybe what they could mean, and maybe not necessarily with the goal of reviving these things, you know, as they were in the past, but maybe developing our own understanding of Konane about what it is today. And if we could, you know, derive a series of opening theory or mid-game theory or end-game theory that will help players hone their craft and become more skilled, then I'm all for it. Like we should develop that. And I think that makes the game a lot more accessible to folks too. When you can name something, it's easier to register in your head and it's easier to remember, and you could just keep going at it.
And on that subject of making Konane accessible to folks, can you tell me, where can someone learn how to play Konane? Are there groups? I mean, I know you are associated one, so please tell me all about it.
Yeah, well, I have a small kind of impromptu hui going on every week over at Avaho. It's a kava lounge right near the university. We usually meet every Tuesday. But I think there's definitely a lot of potential to kind of expand the access right now. And I think this tournament is definitely part of that. One of the big goals of this tournament was to kind of elevate the status of it, that, you know, we could tell the world or tell people in our community here in Hawaii that our game is complex. It is dignified, right? It stands tall right next to the great abstract strategy games of the world like chess and Go. And, you know, in our olden days, people who were really good at Konane were seen with a lot of respect. And I think that's something really, really interesting about this particular piece of cultural heritage that we have. So all that to say, you know, you can find me on Instagram at Pakonane. I'll post about where I'll be. You can find me everywhere, usually just with a bunch of boards playing what I call Gorilla Konane out in the wild. I just love it. I just love the community that I just come across and see. And folks will like come up to me in the grocery store and say, like, hey, we saw you playing Konane over here. And I'm like, yeah, that was me. it was probably me. I don't think it'd be anyone else.
You obviously love Konane, I can tell. What is it about the game that really is just this impetus, this driver for you to love it so much?
You know, I really do think about this a lot. There's just something about it that, you know, Konane, it's very easy to learn. You can teach it to a three-year-old, and a three-year-old's going to know what to do. But there's some level of brilliance where you have just a very simple basic rule set, yet it will take you a lifetime to really understand it at a really advanced level. Yeah. And it's that like depth, that complexity that's possible from it that keeps me coming back to it. That it's this puzzle. In Hawaiian, nane. Nane means puzzle or a riddle. In konane, like the word is in it. And I think that was something that Okupuna understood, that they created a framework or this thing, right, that you can just stare into. Sometimes I will close my eyes and I'll see it kind of move in my head, right? I like to say that konane is all about pattern making and pattern recognition. So I'll like see konane patterns in my head when I close my eyes and figure out, you know, how do I make this like this, or how do I undo it? Things like that. I don't know. There's just something about it that really just kind of gets me. And that could be, you know, some like ancestral kind of something inside of me that like says you're meant to do this. Like this is something that was for you. And that's something I really encourage other Hawaiians to recognize about our heritage game, that this is for us, right? This was made by us, for us. And I think it's incumbent upon us to share it with each other and to share it with the world.
Share that heritage game with the world. That was the conversation's Kevin Allen, who spoke with Konani player Kapena Baptista. Find out more about Konani and how it's played by following Baptista on Instagram at pa.konani.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
The midterms are just months away, and the balance of Congress is at stake. Elections are a constitutionally protected state-run affair. What President Trump wants?
The Republicans should say, we want to take over. We should take over the voting in at least many, 15 places. The Republicans ought to nationalize the voting.
Are the midterms under threat? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
And now it's time to hatch the answer to our backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about an endemic group of species that sometimes is described as the helicopters of the insect world. Their incredibly fast wing motion allows them to hover in midair and to reach speeds of up to 35 miles per hour. They have large mouths and can catch small, unlucky insects and gobble them up as they continue flying. One local species has a 6-inch wingspan and is believed to be the largest insect of its kind in the U.S. They're usually found near freshwater and are often seen around taro fields where they breed. Sadly, though, the introduction of rats and mosquito fish have led to declines in the populations of these native insects. We asked you to name these beautiful insects. In Hawaiian, one species is referred to as pinau. We were looking for Hawaiian dragonflies and damselflies. And in case you were wondering, artist Paul Saviscus created the stainless steel sculpture of a pinau that graces the bandstand pond at Kapi'olani Park. And congrats to Brian Connolly. You are our winner today. Boy, this question blew up our phone lines. That's our quiz today. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Bodacious, groovalicious, funk, and jazz. That's what you can expect from the Bay Area jazz duo
Amendola versus Blades. Scott Amendola and Will Blades have graced Hawaii's stages before separately. Percussionist Amendola has played with guitar greats Charlie Hunter and Pat Metheny. Blades was a member of the reggae group Groundation, The Next Generation. His instrument is the Hammond B3 organ. The duo returns to the islands for one show only at Blue Note Hawaii tomorrow night. The Conversation's Lillian Song spoke to them about their unique sound. They met on a performance of the Duke Ellington album Far East Suite in 2006. Amendola says deep friendship is what's behind the fun they have improvising live on stage.
I love the drums and I love playing music. So the drums are my way in to really the higher thing of music and playing with Will and that connection we have. You know, he's one of very few people, in my opinion, on the planet that actually plays the Hammond, being that he plays the pedals and he really knows the inner workings and how to get great sounds out of it that are constantly evolving. I mean, it's a very deep instrument and there's not a lot of people that are as expressive on it as he is. So for someone like me who is trying to be really expressive on my instrument, like it's very exciting and freeing. And, you know, there's an unpredictability because we're both deep improvisers and that's a big part of what we do. So the way that he's able to do that on the instrument, you know, allows us to dig deeper as a duo and then me on my instrument to dig deeper. So the possibilities seem endless. And with an instrument that on one hand you look at, you think it's finite, and then you play with someone like Will, you realize like that's actually not true. You know, so that's one of the many things that excites me about playing with him.
And Will, legendary late Dr. Lonnie Smith, called you the future. He's passed on that mantle, carrying on the legend and the legacy of the organ of the B3. What does it feel like having that on your shoulders as you move forward as a musician and then bringing that to your duo?
Lonnie said that a long time ago when I was pretty young. And to be clear, he also had a lot of other young organists he was mentoring. So there's a handful of us out there that were sort of under his wing. But it's definitely a heavy, you know, now that he's passed and all the greats of the B3 are pretty much gone, except for really just a couple. It feels like a responsibility at this point. I went to this sort of like witch shop in Pasadena and pulled this thing off the ceiling that said, "Do not wrong the dead." And I put that on my organ as a reminder, because Lonnie was like very adamant about, you know, every time we sit down at our instruments, it's a tribute to the people before us. So, but yeah. And then just as far as playing with Scott, I think we're both similar, for the most part, similar interests in music as far as what we value in it, which is rhythm and expression and musicality and dynamics. So playing with Scott, first off, it's just great to play with friends professionally. I'm realizing the value of that more and more as I get older and how important it is to just make music with your friends more so than trying to just play with whatever great musicians, because that's where the true expression can come, I feel like. And so our musical relationship is very like freeing and conversational, and Scott's way of playing really, I guess, hammers that home for me, because he's very free with everything. And also he's a drummer, obviously. So he's got a pocket and he values groove. So it's not just all free and, you know, freewheeling or whatever, but there's no mistakes. Like, we just throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks, you know, and there's not really mistakes. We allow each other to just kind of play. Sometimes things go off the rails a little bit, but they don't, because it's just the two of us having a conversation, you know? So it's a very freeing musical experience playing with Scott.
And for audience members who have yet to really see you in person to witness this live conversation between two master musicians, when you do your live gigs, you are set up differently than traditional concerts where the audience is facing you, you're facing the audience. you two are actually set up where you are looking at each other. This makes for better, I guess, communication, body language-wise, also maybe reacting to what you're seeing across the way. So on a B3, Will, describe that. It's not a small instrument, is it?
No, it's a piece of furniture. It's huge. These days, I try not to move one around too often. I mostly book gigs at places that have them. It's because it's not only the actual organ, but the Leslie speaker that goes with it is basically like a big cabinet, like dresser drawer set almost. It's ridiculous to play it professionally. But at the same time, you know, there's nothing else like it. There's a lot of digital keyboards out there and stuff that try to emulate it, and they do very good now, but it's nothing like the original thing. You know, it's literally 1934 technology, and it still sounds so good, and it still works, you know? That's the crazy part.
Have you ever been on a gig where maybe a part blew or you had to fix
organ?
What happens in that point?
I can laugh now, but at the moment when it happens, it's not funny.
Yeah, I mean, there's never been like a huge catastrophe where I
could play. Remember High Sierra?
Oh, yeah.
Charlie Hunter saved the gig.
Yeah. I don't remember what was wrong with the organ, but every time I would switch. So, you know, the Leslie speaker has two speeds, a slow speed and a fast speed. And every time I would switch it, there'd be a big loud pop through the entire PA. I can't remember what else was wrong, but it was at the end of the weekend. I was not in a good mood.
and what's Charlie Hunter was guesting. We just said, hey, come play with us. And, you know, Charlie plays bass and guitar at the same time. He's like the organ player of the guitar. And poor Will, like the problem with some of these festivals is they just don't take care of these instruments and you're dealing with the elements. And I just remember Will was struggling like the whole set. But fortunately, Charlie could kind of cover it when things weren't working. And then it was just one of those things when you know, the techs are helping and trying to make it work. And one of the things you have to understand is that Will is so deep in the organ that I've seen him do this. We show up at a sound check, even with his own instrument, but mostly when it's not his own instrument, he's kind of checking it and he might have to fix like the pedals, like the way that they connect or like the wires, you know, he's gotten in there with a screwdriver. Sometimes it's like, shoot, we got to solder something. It's because it's old. It's, you know, there's digital organs and they sound okay, but the real thing is it's so much different. So, you know, Will's learned. I know how to fix a drum, but like if a drum is like half working, I can still play it. But if with an organ, if it's a whole other thing.
Yeah. You have to, if you play Hammond, you have to know how to fix it at least a little bit. Some of that skill has been because they've broken on gigs and I have had to just figure it out on a gig. So like some basic skills, although I'm, you know, there's other stuff that is best left to attack, especially when it comes to electricity.
Good point. But how long are your sets? How long is this evening of music that you bring to stage?
Well, this show in Hawaii, there's an opener, so there's going to be, I don't know, like a 30, 40 minute set before us. And I think we'll play 75 minutes, but we've played for as long as like 2 hours. But, you know, a duo, it all depends on where we're playing and how it goes. But, you know, like a good 75, 90 minute set is generally what we'll do, you know, if we're not doing two sets.
And your moniker is Amendola versus Blades. Talk about that versus in your moniker.
It's a name that I guess I came up with. You know, band names, impossible to come up with good band names. And I sort of came up with it kind of as a joke, but it plays on our friendship and our musical relationship is like, you know, it's like a fun little musical tussle on stage. That's kind of it, really. We're just having a good time. And since it's a duo, might as well be versus because, you know, most of the time I win.
Rebuttal, Will?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's worth responding to. But yeah, I think it's a great name. Just, I mean, for a duo, you know, and the fact that we face each other on stage and it's a very conversational situation in terms of how we perform, and there's a lot of humor in what we do, just in terms of how we interact when we play and the freeness in which we play with when we play. And we're also just, you know, like to jab each other a lot as men like to do sometimes. And so, yeah, it's a very fitting name for our relationship.
Do you guys just kind of segue through the music, or do you stop and do you actually like talk with the audience as well?
Oh, yeah.
Talk sometimes. I mean, it's funny because that's a good question, because like sometimes when I was younger as a band leader, I realized I was talking way too much. I'm like, these people didn't come to hear me talk, you know? So we have a sort of natural flow, because like one of the things that Will said earlier, just about how, you know, freeing we are, like we might play through a bunch of songs, and if he starts something or if I start something at the end of something, we segue into something. It's like there'll be some organic stopping point and where we know, well, oh, okay, let's say something, you know, but it could go on for a while before we do that. But the thing is that I think one of the things maybe we alluded to earlier on about the name and about our friendship and about our camaraderie is that comes out, and that is a part of what's happening on stage. And so you're going to get plenty of that. Like, we might talk about a song or two, like song titles or something, but there's plenty of dialogue happening between us and between the audience. So it's kind of covered, I guess.
Musicians with a sense of humor. We just heard from percussionist Scott Amendola and organist Will Blades talking to HBR's Lillian Song. You can catch their show, Amendola versus Blades, tomorrow night at Blue Note Hawaii. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to learn about how new research is looking into avian malaria, how it's spreading through our forests, and why it's been so devastating for native birds. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find The Conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.